In any case, I thought I would tell you about some ideas about this curious class transition. I must say, I've worked on a whole lot of things in my career, I don't know when I've ever seen a problem that is, on the one hand, deeper, more beautiful, and on the other hand, so surrounded in controversy in my opinion, misunderstanding and people's psyches and things like that.
How about turbid?
It's even worse than turbid. For reasons that I think are probably fairly deep. What I'd like to do is I'd like to start by telling you where I see, where everybody really sees the deep mystery of the subject. I'll review some of that stuff for you, because I understand that nobody, or very few people here, are, I hope, experts in class theory. I'd like to introduce a few of my own ideas about, really, what I've said in a Phys Rev letter and other ways publicly. I see more as a framework in which we could begin to understand some of these problems, rather than a detailed solution of them. As I go along the way, I'll point out where I know some of my own stuff is completely incomplete. So let me start by talking about glass and dynamics. And obviously this is going to be a simplified presentation. I'm just going to hit a couple of the main features. And one of the most important things that everybody notices, because we know what window glass is that it is a highly viscous solid. In fact, it seems like a solid to us. Quantitatively, that means that if I plot here, I'm going to plot the logarithm of the viscosity, which is essentially the same thing as the logarithm of some relaxation time, which is conventionally called tau alpha, an alpha relaxation time. That's just notation. And you plot that as a function of temperature. And what you discover is that you get a curve that looks something like this. And here, the viscosity is of the order of 1 in some units, and here it's of the order of 10 to the 13. Units happen to be called poise. And if I think hard enough, I can define that. But the important point is the number of orders of magnitude of this. And so far as anybody can tell, this curve seems to have an asymptote. Nobody knows for sure. To go to infinity at some temperature, which is, I'm going to call Ck, because it's usually thought of as something like the Kautzmann temperature. I'm going to show you why Kautzmann thought this was an important temperature. Yeah, can you? Oh. I just thought I was being clever. Is this the mic's dead?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm in good shape. Sometimes this temperature here is called the glass temperature. That's where this goes through nominally something of the order of 13 orders of magnitude higher than what it is out of here at Marietta. Yeah.
Okay.
Jim?
Yeah? Well, in fact, that's exactly right, is that people... there's a standard way of fitting this, is that you say that the log of eta is proportional to 1 over t minus tk. And there's numbers and stuff like that to make it... What?
there,
well, that's the log of eta.
No, I know that, but is it exponent 1 in the 1 over t?
Oh, to one, well, again, that's controversial, but the power, nobody can prove that 1 is not as good as, it, as anything else, and it's probably better, and anyway, that's what comes out of my theory. Okay. And so this is, you know, a very dominant feature, that, that something seems to happen at some temperature like this. Nobody really even knows whether it goes up really to infinity at that point or whether it just gets much, much greater than anybody can measure. Oh, it's probably 400 or 500 degrees K. You know what it is, because you know that glass will start flowing when it gets red hot, right? And so that's roughly, you know, what's happening. And then below here, that's what we really call a glass. This is what we call a glass-forming liquid or a glass-forming material of some sense. Whether it's a liquid, strictly speaking, or not, we'll see. And below here, everything seems to be just completely frozen up. For all intents and purposes, it acts like a solid. It has no linear Newtonian viscosity whatsoever. And if you try to push it too hard, it just breaks. It's brittle. But the other really interesting experimental phenomenon is that when you look at this closely, like with X-ray scattering or other kind of neutron scattering, stuff like that, for the most part, there's beginning to be a little bit of information that says that it's different, and I'll get to that. This looks like just both sides look the same, and they look like a liquid. The molecules in these materials are somehow, you know, they don't fit together nicely in a lattice. They don't make a crystal. We say that the interactions are somehow frustrated, so that the nearest neighbor correlations that they like don't fit into tiling the whole plane or the whole volume, and therefore it looks like a liquid. And that's really, I think, quite important. Now, look, there are other features about the glass-forming liquid, which I'm not going to talk about today, called stretched exponential decay and things like that. But for purposes of getting through some ideas more quickly, let's leave those things out. Yeah?
How broad is the class of substances besides ordinary glass that
you would... Oh, in enormous polymers, almost all polymers can be much more easily made into glasses. Metals. We now know that we've known for a long time that if you splat cool most metals, they become amorphous. They make metallic glasses. Now people have got chemical constituents, 5 components for some of the ones, and they can make bulk metallic glasses. And there's a group of people that are, in fact, somebody I know at Caltech is making golf clubs out of these things, except that. The last time, last year I gave a talk, and I said that I showed the picture of one of his golf clubs, and somebody said, but you know, the PGA has just outlawed them because the coefficient of restitution is just. So I didn't know that. All right. Let me talk next.
I missed what sets the horizontal line, i.e. the difference between these two temperatures.
Oh, well, this is, as David said, this is somewhere above room temperature usually for most glasses, and then this is 10 or 15 degrees higher than that, and this is, it's all over the map.
Yeah, but sort of this horizontal line at 10 to 30.
Oh, just what sets that?
Yes.
There's one of the great men in the field from whom I've learned an enormous amount called Austin Angel, and he defined it that way. But it's not so dumb. I'm not sure that he actually defined it, but people thought, well, that's as viscous as anything can become, so we'll call that the glass temperature. it's an old field. it's not the way physicists would do it, and we now sort of work around that definition without too much trouble. Well, actually, it's going, the time scale itself is also going up very fast. It's, you know, of the order of milliseconds or in seconds, and then years, and then very quickly gets up to much longer than a graduate student is willing to do an experiment. And as far as anybody's concerned, that's the age of the universe, right? All right, now, let's look at glass equilibrium thermal. And now I'm going to do the standard kind of a picture. Again, it's going to be temperature here. And the standard kind of experiment, the one that I want most to stress right here, is a sort of calorimetric experiment. And the best thing to plot here is the entropy, but I'm going to specialize to the configurational entropy. And look, you have to just allow the experimentalists and the theorists to have a whole lot of leeway in this, because what you're trying to get out of here is you're trying to get rid of all the vibrational motion, subtract that out, and talk about just the entropy associated with configurations of molecules that fit together. And we are really going to do this experiment by measuring, you know, specific heats and doing differential scanning calorimetry, and you're going to go up and down. But the basic idea is that there's a curve that sort of looks like this. As I come down in temperature, the entropy seems to go down. Now, what happens is that if I cool this thing at a reasonable rate, then I fall off this curve, and it will do something like that. If I heat back up, actually it will come by and do, it'll come down a little bit and come up like that, implying that somehow what you've done is you've trapped a certain amount of energy or enthalpy or whatever in the system, and then as you heat up, it gets released. So that I've probably exaggerated this. If you cool more slowly, you can get further down before it starts doing that. The idea, and this was first pointed out by Kautzmann, 50 years ago at least, that if you sort of extend this down here, it looks as if this configurational entropy actually vanishes at something called the Kautzmann temperature, which for all intents and purposes seems to be indistinguishable from this temperature at which the viscosity diverges. Okay? So the conclusion from this is that there is some sort of deep connection between the thermodynamics and the dynamics of what's occurring at this glass transition somewhere here. Now, in this room, people are going to say, what's strange about that? After all, we're all familiar with critical phenomena and critical slowing down. But that implies that there would be some sort of a phase transition here. And indeed, that's been the assumption of something like half the people in the world who've worked on this subject for maybe 50 years, too. I will get to a little bit more of this later on. I think that there's very likely, in fact, there's recent numerical evidence that we could talk about later that implies that there really isn't any phase transition, that there's no ideal glass transition that occurs here, at least not for molecules that are interacting with short-range forces. There's already some sort of a mystery, and I'm going to elaborate on that right now. is, you know, what happens if you, what's the nature of the work that says, well, there ought to be, there seems to be a phase transition going on there.
So, lack of phase transition would mean that all of a sudden the quantities
are functions of phase? Yeah. Yeah. But you may, it may be intrinsically impossible to measure them.
So is the zero point of your configuration entropy arbitrary, or?
No, in fact, usually people are measuring this from the known entropy of the crystal that also conforms. And so, in fact, the Kautzmann paradox was that it seemed to him is that what was happening was that the entropy of the glass-forming liquid seemed to be getting smaller than the entropy of the crystal. And he said, well, that can't be, and let's just forget it. Okay, but it's clearly true. People have looked harder and harder at this, you know, spending more and more time with graduate students, cooling more and more slowly, and using sophisticated ways of going back, seeing, making sure that this is reversible, because that's the definition of what we mean by equilibrium thermodynamics. And indeed, this curve, you know, it seems to be coming down like that.
You're including in glasses.
I'm going to make a remark. The next remark is spin glasses. Okay, because the question is, okay, what kinds of theories have people developed to try to understand something like this? And the most common kind of a theory, so here let's say equilibrium phase transition with a question mark. And that comes out of a whole bunch of absolutely, yeah, I wish I'd done some of this work. It's beautiful stuff. In fact, David knows about some of it. They're basically mean field or infinitely long range forces. And usually these things are formulated in terms of spin glasses, where I have a, well, an energy, which is, you know, something, well, usually it's written J, I, J, K, etc., and then there's sigma I, sigma J, sigma K, etc., because you can put interactions between many spins on this thing. And this is a random interaction matrix, and usually, in fact, essentially always, what people do is they go to the limit of everybody here interacting with everybody else. There are recent attempts to move a little bit away from that. But the first thing that, you know, I just want to point out is that that's not a very realistic model for window glass, or for almost any of these other glasses. It may be a not too bad a model for certain kinds of spins in random fields with long-range interactions between them. But it certainly does not seem to be a realistic model for this kind of thing. Nevertheless, what it does is it actually produces a finite temperature at which the entropy vanishes. And indeed, that is effectively a phase transition. Essentially, what happens is that all of the states of the system, the thermodynamic state, collapses into a non-extensive number of states, meaning that the entropy has vanished at a finite temperature as you get down there. And therefore, the idea has been to try to use those kinds of mean field theories to understand. You say, okay, this is going to give me some sort of an explanation of the equilibrium thermodynamics. How can I use that to understand the dynamics? And here is where maybe I should turn the loudspeaker off. Or the recorder off, because I don't understand, but I deeply don't understand the rationale between for this, because what people have tried to do in order to get from here to there using this is they've done things like something that, as you many of you know, I really like droplet models and kinds of stuff like that. They say, well, look, what's going on in this system is that I have a material that has lots and lots of molecules in some sort of disordered state, and I've got to somehow figure out how to make these molecules change places. This goes there and that goes there. I have to make some sort of rearrangements. And if this is very tightly jammed, then you can sort of understand, and this is the basis of a lot of stuff that I'm going to be talking about, that, well, if I get lower and lower in temperature, and the activation energies for moving these things around are bigger and bigger compared to the KT, it may be that what I've got to do is have larger and larger groups of things rearranging cooperatively in order for me to have any kind of viscous response for the system. So that's the basic idea that you get into. But now the question is, well, how do you understand these cooperative rearrangements? And the idea that has been prevalent in the literature for at least a decade, Peter Wallin has told me he invented it while he was at an ITP program in the 1980s. And if I didn't like it, why didn't I tell him then? the idea has been to talk about, I'm going to put here with a question mark, things like entropically favored droplets, and use those as, well, people use the word instantons, that will enable these kinds of transitions to take place. And I have two objections. One I've already stated is that they're using results from a mean field theory in which the longest length scale in the system has to be the range of the interactions, whereas whatever region here is rearranging is necessarily a finite size region, and therefore, well, but it, you go from here to, and you wave your hands and you say, okay, here's a mean field kind of theory. But the results of the mean field theory are always based on results that you get from doing calculations like this, lovely elaborations, replica methods and stuff like that. But they come up with something like an equilibrium free energy that they want to use as the free energy of the energy of the activation energy of this droplet. But of course they've got to then decide on things like surface energies and boundary conditions and stuff like that. But there's a deeper reason that bothers me, and that's the following. What I'm talking about here are the basic transitions that occur within a system that allow rearrangements to occur, and those are the transitions that allow me to use a Gibbs assumption. In other words, I can go and say that I have a computer partition function, which is a sum over states of e to the minus e over kt, etc., and I sum over all of those states, and I make the assumption that that my system is sampling all of those states on timescales which are short compared to the measurement timescale. Okay?
I thought one of the conclusions.
Yeah. You have a breakdown of ergodicity presumably after you get below here. It's broken at that point, But this I'm talking about here is presumably a reversible thermodynamic state of the system. So I should not have any breakdown of ergodicity up in here, although I made the mistake of suggesting that in print at one point, but that's forget about that. I've corrected that. So the important point is that, but look, what they're doing is something that seems to me to be utterly circular. They're saying, okay, I'm going to calculate a transition rate, assuming that I have some sort of transition state that's some activated entropically favored droplet. The properties of that activated entropically favored droplet I'm going to compute, assuming that I can use Gibbsian statistical mechanics. And then I'm going to use that rate to come back here and calculate the rates that are relevant to this, which should have been the same rates.
Well, it's
not. Well, no, it's circular. I think it's wrong. Okay. No, it's not self-consistent because you see, you should have then used that rate to figure out to what extent your thermodynamic approximation was correct, and you've not done that. You've not done that. Okay. I really think that that's although Peter Wallinus, among others, assures me that that by doing this he makes predictions and all the predictions are quantitatively correct and he can explain all the data. I think if you look at that a little bit harder, you're not quite so pleased anyway. But in any case, I see these as being questions that certainly need to be answered if one is to understand any of those calculations. I should mention in this connection a beautiful paper by Jean-Philippe Bouchot and Biroli, who have really tried to look at some of those things critically, and which, as they know, I have said, yes, I really love that paper, but I just draw the opposite conclusion from by the time you end it. All right. I don't want to take too much more time, but I want to talk about some of my own ideas here. And what I'm going to insist is that we should at least make a model of these transitions where I have molecules that are pushing or bumping into each other, interacting with each other via short-range interactions. And I want to ask, well, here's this little picture here. I want to think about being above this temperature in a region where I can think about thermodynamic fluctuation somehow being effective. And I want to ask, well, what sort of rearrangements might occur? Well, here I have the help of a whole lot, a growing amount of even some experimental stuff, but also especially numerical simulations by Sharon Glotzer and people like that. What people have been seeing recently is that when they look in a computer simulation, usually molecular dynamics, and they start coming down in temperature, they discover that the motions in which the molecules actually rearrange each other, technically the motions that lead you from one, what's called an inherent state of the system to another, which is one configuration to another, that the motions consist of chain-like motions. In other words, I have a whole bunch of molecules again. And suppose that what I'm interested in doing, I want to see how it happens, is I want to think about making some sort of a density fluctuation. Spontaneously create a density fluctuation, or spontaneously, obviously, I can reverse it and make it go away. But suppose that I want this molecule to move out of that position, so it leaves it empty, and move into some position out here. Okay. What's seen in the simulations is that that's not exactly what happens. What actually happens is that this molecule moves here. It bumps that guy. This one bumps that guy. Maybe there's somebody else over here. And so that there's a sort of a chain of displacements. And that's the most probable, seems to be the most probable way for these things to happen. If you think about it hard enough, you can convince yourself that that's about right. So what I tried to do, this is now about a year and a half ago, it's all still relatively recently, I tried to say, okay, let's try to make a statistical theory of that kind of an excitation. So I said, well, let's let the...
Excuse me, are these like exchanges or like...
No, I want this guy to move here, him to move there.
Is it Brownian motion?
Well, it's like a Brownian motion because in the path that it takes. But this actual molecule doesn't actually move there. He leaves a hole there, that's sort of a hole, and pushes other guys around. Okay? Yeah. That's right. Well, look, I can do it either way. I can say that this guy here is a bit like an interstitial. Okay, he's sitting in a place where he maybe has a little bit more energy, and this is like a vacancy. Okay, so and that's what I mean by a density fluctuation in this material. I want to make a density fluctuation in which I have a little bit less density here and a little bit more density there. And I want to, yeah.
Should I think of this as like a path integral or just along a blue path?
Well, I'm going to have to sum over paths, so in that sense it's going to be a path integral.
But should I think of it as being dominated by a few or like a sort of along many?
I think what you want to do is, remember what you're doing is you're calculating a transition rate, okay? And that transition, I'm going to do this for you explicitly in a second, well, more or less explicitly. And what I'm going to say is that, I have to do a certain activation energy to get that thing to happen. But then if there are lots of different ways in which it can happen, it's going to be more likely. I want to calculate a transition probability. Okay? So that's exactly what I'm going to do next. So let's do that. I'm going to calculate something I'll call delta G as a sort of activation energy for this process. And so what am I going to have? I've got n links. And so I'm going to have n times some energy E naught, which is presumably, because in order to make these things move across, I've got each one has to go over some energy barrier. So there's going to be that. There's going to be another term. What you'll notice, those of you who do polymer physics, notice that I'm doing a calculation that's not very different, although it will turn out to be a bit different, from Fleury's calculation of the statistics of polymer chains. I've got to include, and it turns out that this is important, that these links shouldn't cross each other. That if obviously, in order to have this kind of a motion happen, I've got to let the molecules outside move away, and therefore, if I try to get this to happen twice at the same place, I'm going to have trouble. So I better put in an exclusion term, and that's going to have the form of n squared. This is the mean field Fleury approximation. Divided by r cubed, and for purposes of this talk, I'm going to leave all coefficients unspecified. Okay. Then I've got to put down here minus the temperature times the log of some number of ways in which it can happen, because that's what I'm computing. I'm computing a transition probability. And so what is W? Well, W is... Well, the first thing I'll say is that at any one of these steps, I can go some number of ways. By the way, this is a three-dimensional. The r cubed is the 3 is the dimensionality of the system. And so that there's some number which I'll call q to the n. And actually, I usually write this as e to the n nu, because I want to put all these stuff, these things back in the exponent again. And so there's that kind of a contribution to this. But in addition to that, well, the usual thing in Flurry is he'll say, is that he'll have something like r squared over 2n, because he says, well, this is making a random walk, and I'm keeping track of how large this thing is, so that there's some sort of a length scale r that's going to be extremely important in what I'm going to say. This, however, is going to turn out to be negligible, because the much more important term, at least in the experimental range of interest, is something that I've written minus gamma n. And gamma is an inverse, I'm sorry, gamma r. And gamma is essentially an inverse molecular spacing. And this is coming from the fact that I have an intrinsically disordered system. By definition, a glass is disordered. There's no regularity in it. Those of you here doing quantum many-body theory will recognize this as the decay term in a Green's function for an electron propagating through a disordered system, except that there you want this gamma to be small in order to have it right. And this is admittedly one of the places where this theory is weakest. I have a few more ideas about how to do this than what I've published so far. But this seems to be absolutely essential. And what it's saying is a sort of a localization term. It says that the system is strongly constrained to lie in the regions where the potential is most favorable. And that's the essence of localization in electronic theory too. So you put these things together. So what I have here is delta G. Now this is so far as a function of N and R, and of course it has T in it, temperature. And now I'm putting minus gamma R and this N over R cubed upstairs in this exponential. And so what I'll do first is I'll minimize the energy with respect to R. That's essentially repeating the Flurry analysis for the swelling of a polymer. And now to cut to the core, I'm going to plot delta G as a function of N and let's call it R star, because that's the value of R that minimizes this energy. And I'll plot it as a function of N. And now I get two different kinds of behavior. There's a characteristic energy that sits here. And it's what I'm going to call, let's make sure I'm right, using the definition that I want to use. There's an energy, let's call it a temperature. A temperature T naught is E naught over Boltzmann's constant times nu. And if T is less than T naught, and by the way, T naught will turn out to be TK in a second. If T is less than T naught, then delta G just sort of goes up. Was there? No. Which means that the longer the chain I form, the more energetic, the more energy I have to put into it, which means that if I start forming chains of this size, of any size, they're going to evaporate. In other words, it's always energetically favorable on thermal fluctuations for these chains if they form it to go away. It's very much like the droplet model of condensation. By the way, this is the first time in about 40 years that I've taken a lot of advantage of a really very remarkably astute collaborator who lives in my filing cabinet. I've really never referred to some of these old theories of the calculations of mine on purpose, because, you know, if you keep on redoing the same thing, that you're in trouble. But I couldn't avoid it here, because the point is that if I go do this thing at t less than, at t greater than t zero, then this thing bends around, and so that there's an energy barrier that this thing has to, that this chain has to overcome at something we call, might call n star, and so this is delta g star. And if it gets bigger than that, then the chain can in principle get as long as it likes. And indeed, basically what's happening is that I'm ionizing this vacancy interstitial pair. They can go get away from each other, and that's exactly what I want to happen. Whereas if I just form a small chain, it just goes part of the way, then in fact, and the next thermal fluctuations come around, it just sort of collapses. So what I need to do is I need to have this thing get over this energy barrier and form a chain. Now, it turns out to be a back of the envelope calculation, and I'm just going to show you this. The R star as a function of T actually diverges like 1 over T minus T0. And delta G star actually also goes like 1 over T minus T0. So if this is the activation energy for rearrangements to occur, I've reproduced, I've recovered really remarkably easily the what's called the Vogel-Fulcher kind of behavior that sits here. But I've got another bonus, is that I've also got out of this calculation a characteristic length scale that can characterize the system. And again, now, I don't know how seriously to take this analysis, but it's so simple that I can't resist presenting it, because this gives me a clue about how to connect. See, here I've got the dynamics coming out of this, but it gives me a clue about how to connect that to the thermodynamics, because look what's happening here. What I'm saying is that I have a length scale, okay? And my glassy material, if I have a region of, we'll think about this as sort of glassy material in the system. What I'm coming to is an argument in favor of finding heterogeneities in glass-forming systems, which, by the way, seems to be experimentally becoming respectable. If I have such a region which is bigger than R star, so if I say here, this is R greater than R star, then I'm going to be able to form these excitation chains in this region, and I will form some sort of density fluctuations. Essentially, the system in thermal activation will find itself able to disorder itself. And what I maintain is that then this is going to be unstable and is going to break up into smaller regions. Now, why should there be regions at all? Well, the picture that you want to think about, let me change this a little bit. Let's say that this is R, approximately R star. And the picture that you want to think about is that, well, I have these disordered regions in the system. I'm making some sort of a domain structure. And then maybe there's some other regions of order, roughly R star. And in between these regions are regions of higher disorder. Presumably, these regions which are not so they're necessarily disordered like a glass, because they are. But this is sort of the something like the glass state that's going to form when I get down below this transition temperature, whatever it means. But above that transition temperature, regions of this state are unstable against becoming against these density fluctuations. And now I have to ask, well, what's the system really going to look like? Well, it seems perfectly reasonable to me to say that I'm going to get a domain structure where energetically this kind of a region is favorable, but entropically the other kind of region is favorable, so that maybe what I have is something like a separation between sort of glassy regions, glassy domains, and these disordered kinds of regions. And now this is a completely very rough idea, but it has one neat result. Again, a completely back of the envelope calculation that I can say, well, maybe the configurational entropy then for the system is going to look like the surface to volume ratio of these regions of size R star. In other words, these get as big as they can up to this sort of limit of R star, but then there's some stuff around the outside. So if I say that this, the surface to volume ratio always goes like 1 over the radius. I mean, obviously there's some number there. And therefore, because R star is going like 1 over T minus T zero, the configurational entropy would vanish, or at least would extrapolate to zero at this value T zero. So T zero in fact looks very much like the Kautzmann temperature. Now I can push this argument even a bit further. For example, people have measured take the specific heat, for example, which is C partial of S with respect to T, and it seems to look something like that, and people measure this jump, which would be something like the slope of this thing coming down, and what's been observed recently is that this jump in the specific heat scales like the so-called fragility, which is the slope of this curve. Again, one of Austin Angel's inventions. And that's exactly what drops out of here. Another thing that drops out in an interesting way is that when you put all of these formulas together, the R star, and if you evaluate it at the actual glass temperature, this one where this thing is at it turns out to be independent of this fragility, and that's exactly what drops out of here. So that it looks to me as if qualitatively all of the main features work out. The numbers obviously uncertain to factors of 2 or 5 or something like that, but at this extremely simple level, it looks as if, to me, as if it's promising, and I've been looking at this for the better part of a year, or year, maybe half a year now. Can't tell. It certainly doesn't look qualitatively wrong that it's linearly. That's right. Yeah, and that's the way the data look, but they're not getting close to here. Okay. And look, Jim, the other thing that you want to realize is that all of this analysis doesn't really say what goes on if I get closer and closer here. In fact, the analysis that I've made here clearly doesn't work if I have to extend it to very, very long chains. The chains that show up when I fit this data, this theory to experiment, there may be 30 spaces long, something like that. when they get closer down there. I have a strong suspicion that there's different mathematics that's coming in when you get to chains that are 1,000 spacings long. And that's borne out by a number of other kinds of theory or numerical simulations of what they call the kinetically constrained models of glassy dynamics, which automatically, by the way, have no thermodynamics in them whatsoever, but give you a mechanism for seeing how this may work. The recent numerical simulations published by Donev, Stillinger, and Torquato for hard disk systems make it appear that when you get down to some place where the system is completely jammed, in other words, there's no motion that can occur or that they can make occur, no matter how big, well, they can't make the system too big, it still has a very finite entropy. So it's probable that for those kinds of systems, there's something happening here that does something like that, but nobody knows. Yeah. Oh yeah. No, there's a number. There's a number. It has to do with the value of this gamma and the strength of the interaction that goes there, and all of those things get sort of fit in.
So is that roughly consistent?
Yeah. No. In this particular case, it's maybe a factor of 5, but depending. But I don't know what gamma is, so a factor of 5.
In the end, the particular
microscopic model doesn't allow what you're saying.
Yeah.
But it would affect the density. Well, that's what Swagatam and I are working on. Is that you say, well, this model seems to predict a certain heterogeneity. And at least it predicts a length scale for the heterogeneity, and it predicts that that molecules that are in this disordered region are going to be more mobile than others, and therefore that makes then predictions of things like diffusion behavior, and people have looked at that. Again, it's a big field, lots of people working on it, but I think we have a somewhat better way of doing that. We can even also get out of this sort of picture, using those techniques, something like stretched exponential decay of correlations, which I've not talked about at all. Let me finish by making one other remark. I just want to get back to this picture. Well, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure, because I'm... you've done it already. Okay, it's not, as I say, it's the back of the envelope calculation. But you don't want to do that, because you know that that the essence of glasses is not one-dimensional, right? Okay. That makes sense. But the question is, does it make sense in two dimensions? And I'm not so sure. Okay, but there's some other subtleties having to do with how you calculate the effect of disorder on these propagators. I wanted to make just one concluding remark, because to get back to this question of whether there's a phase transition going on, is that after all, this looks very much like what you do if you're talking about nucleation of droplets in a supersaturated vapor. And if you're not supersaturated, then the activation energy is a function of the droplet size. Just gets bigger and bigger, and that tells you that there's no, in the modern language, no instant time that carries you from one phase to another. And it looks very similar. Okay, I'm changing the temperature, and as I change the temperature, I go from this regime to that regime, where there's a a finite activation energy for a fluctuation that is going to take you from one something to another. But now here's a very interesting difference. When I draw this picture for a supersaturated vapor, I know that as soon as I form a droplet, what it does is it gets a supercritical droplet, it grows, and it wipes out the whole system. It converts the whole supersaturated vapor to a liquid. Okay? That's not at all what's happening here. Here, when I get above this temperature, and so I can start, I form a critically large excitation chain. All that excitation chain does is it moves me from one of the microstates of the system to another. All it does is it provides a certain mobility to the system. But it's not changing the phase in any gross way, an analogy to the way a droplet does in a supersaturated vapor. Therefore, if this picture is even accurate, and it may not be, it may be that I get to lower temperatures and I just don't have all the right pieces of the activation process in there. But if it were accurate as is, and it may be at least true to some decent approximation, then what it's saying is that something quite different is happening here. It is a change in the nature of the dynamics of the state, but it is not the same kind of qualitative change that we usually think of as certainly not a first order phase transition. I don't think it's any order phase transition. I think I just sort of close with that remark. But there is, I don't think the entropy actually vanishes. What I said here, but I don't think I want to carry this formula all the way to the place where the entropy vanishes.
If you are below the temperature, then that was my question. Should you have a residual extensive entropy then?
I think
they are everywhere, like to this finite range.
There are certainly below the T0. Yeah, there are going to be fluctuations, and they will be both thermodynamically negligible and dynamically, as far as creating a viscosity, completely negligible. They are still there. I don't think that these formulas can possibly be really correct, extrapolated all the way down to T0. I think that my estimates in here aren't going to work all the way down to T0. But I'm guessing now, completely guessing. My guess is that when you talk about real glasses, what's going to happen is that there's something that happens like this. And that so far, doing a calculation of that is beyond my capabilities, but I keep trying. I may be able to do it. but it requires this really rather subtle calculation of doing the statistics in a highly disordered, for random walks in a very highly disordered material, and there have to be self-excluding random walks. Yeah.
Do you think there is something universal that sets the scale of how low the entropy can go, or do you think it's going to depend on the
I think it's going to depend on the details of the system. For example, this paper, this rev letter by Donev, Stillinger, and Torquato that came out, which, by the way, I think, and I've told them this, I don't even have to turn the microphone on, that I think for ratio of clarity of exposition to importance of results, it has about the smallest value I have ever seen. uh, What they've done is they've looked at a system of hard disks, two dimensions. Okay, knowing them, I'm sure that they've done it very carefully. And they've watched they've computed the entropy as they don't have a temperature, of course. They only can change the density, but things, you know, there's a temperature that tells me that, you know, things are moving around, but it doesn't show, there's no energy scale to talk about, and so their disks can move around each other in some ways. And what they find is that they can come down. Well, this is a temperature plot. Pretend it's density going that way. They can come down and they can follow the entropy coming down to this point. But when they get to a certain point, which, as far as they can tell, and they have a technical term for it, is what they call maximally random jamming. It's a jammed state from which the system can't move. But there are lots of those jammed states from which the system can't move. And therefore they can calculate how many of those jammed states there are, which means the entropy. And that entropy is by no means zero as they get there. I mean, it's a completely extensive quantity. Now, the system that they're using is a system of... it's a binary system. We want it to form a glass, and in two dimensions, if you just put uniform disks in, you're going to form a crystal. So they put two different sizes of their disks in, which frustrates the system and therefore makes it form a glass. And now they can start getting, by other means, not by quenching it essentially, they can get to higher density states, and they find that the higher density states have lower entropies, but still not zero entropy. And finally, they can get to a state that has zero entropy, but what it is that all the A disks have come on one side and all the B disks have come on another side, so it's a phase separated, and it's a crystal. But there's a continuum of states that go from that to this maximally random jammed configuration, which looks for all intents and purposes like what you would think was the glass transition. And I find that pretty compelling, especially in view of some of the things I've been thinking about here. I think that's really what's going on, or close to what's really going on. Yeah.
Jim, on the idea of heterogeneity, people who study low glass fibers communication.
Yeah.
A lot of data on the attenuation of the radio scatter directly related.
Yeah. No, but that's a good source. But now, I have to be a bit careful about that, because you see, this kind of heterogeneity is going to form not in the glass, but only if I equilibrate just above the glass transition. Okay. Usually, when they form those glasses, they quench through here, and so that they don't pick up very much of the information that they would get if they let it sit and equilibrate in that region. So you have to be very careful about these measurements. I'm dubious about some of the recent measurements of using fourth order correlations and to deduce length scales, because I'm not sure that those experiments equilibrate this system long enough at a well-controlled temperature to develop this heterogeneity properly. What does show this kind of thing are some numerical simulations. But even there, you have to wait one hell of a long time and have an awful lot of cycles before you can be sure that you're seeing what you think you're seeing. Yeah.
The people studying spin dynamics frequently use various mappings to dimers and their dynamics on lattices.
Yes.
Is there any chance of using such a mapping to link the spin part, you labeled equilibrium phase transition,
yeah,
with your analysis to account for why the results are so similar in both cases?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that One of the big problems with much of that stuff is that instead of letting the system find its own state of disorder, you build randomness in at the beginning. And that's a hard problem to overcome. But it's a general feature of those kinds of calculations. You maybe should show me more specifically what you're thinking of.
Well, we also get into the thing at the beginning you call PG, that it's the corresponding temperature in the spin system has trust.
No, basically. The TG that's defined here, what you have to do is generalize it and say, well, that's the place where this delta G over KT is itself of order 15 or something like that. And when you do that, then all of a sudden you're considerably more general. Yeah, there's another.
Can you repeat the argument why you don't think there is a phase transition? At the face of this formula, there is a
divergence. Yeah, but I'm all I'm talking about here is, I'm way off this. It's my gut feeling, because I know how uncertain some of these calculations are, and I know how if I try to do them a bit better and get to the stronger disordered system, that different things start happening. And by the way, the strength of the disorder, something else I didn't mention, is that this gamma here is really a temperature dependent thing. There's a number you can see that has to be true, is that I have a certain depth of the potential wells in which these things operate, and so this effective strength of the disorder has to do with the ratio of that depth to the to KT.
I have more difficulty seeing that the calculation may get more subtle, but the fact that there is some diverging R star.
But look, I don't know whether R star really diverges. You see, when I do the thing again with a more complicated temperature dependence that's going to sit there, I my guess is that that R star won't actually diverge. Let me get another example. There's what they call a kinetically constrained set of models one of the first people that did this is Glenn Fredrickson and Hans Andersen, Glenn Fredrickson being here. Recently, a man, Kolb and Andersen, have done a whole lot of really very interesting things. And they make a model where, there's no thermodynamics in it, but there are rules for how rearrangements can possibly occur. And they get something that at first numerically looked as if it was doing something like this, with a divergence in a certain place. But then they were able to do some more analytic calculations, and which showed them that all that was happening was that the necessary length scale in which basically I have to rearrange a whole lot of things in order to make one pair of molecules exchange places or something like that, and that length scale was just growing exponentially with whatever other parameter, the density or equivalently the temperature, so that basically you were just getting a system that as soon as you got a little bit further than this, you needed the size of the universe to make it rearranged during the time of the universe, the age of the universe. It's that kind of divergence that looks as if it's perfectly smooth mathematically, but it may not be very good for laboratory experiments. All right.